The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Mark Weber Report. Mr. Weber is a historian, author, current affairs analyst, and director of the Institute for Historical Review. Visit the IHR at ihr.org. And now, Mark Weber.
Hello and welcome. The other day I received a letter from a woman who supports the Institute for Historical Review. She routinely sends donations to further the IHR's work. She wrote, though, to tell me that her main concern about American society today is not Israel or the conflict in the Middle East, or the Israel-Palestine issue, or even foreign policy generally. She's concerned above all about the economy and the issue of immigration. She accepts that the Palestinians have been badly treated by the Israelis, but takes the view that the seemingly endless conflict between Jews and Arabs in another continent is not all that important or relevant for us here in the United States. Well, I understand her point of view, which is certainly one that's shared by many millions of Americans. But the Israel-Palestine issue is important for Americans. It's important beyond just the question of justice in the Middle East. It's important for what it tells us about American society, about our country's social political system. The way that American political leaders and the U.S. mass media deal with the Israel-Palestine conflict is an expression of a society that is self-deluded, a society that's in denial about basic historical and political realities, a society that routinely betrays the principles it claims to support, a society of ingrained hypocrisy. U.S. policy in the Middle East is set and carried out by political leaders who, with very few exceptions, put their own careers and personal interests above what is good for America and the world, and in doing so, routinely deceive the American public. All this is an expression of a society that has become dangerously corrupt and unhealthy. Even those Americans who don't care much about the Israel-Palestine issue should be alarmed, because political leaders who lack principle, that is, who are fundamentally more concerned about their personal ambitions than about what is good for the nation and the world, cannot be expected to do what is necessary in dealing with any issue, including jobs, the economy, and so forth. Not only in personal life, but in a nation's political and social life, character counts. The Israel-Palestine issue is also important for Americans, because the decades-old U.S. policy of ardent support for the Zionist state puts this country increasingly at odds against the rest of the world. And this is a dangerous position, especially during this time of economic disarray and political uncertainty and disorder. In recent weeks, quite a lot of world attention has focused on the bid by Palestinians for recognition in the United Nations as a member state. President Obama responded with an announcement that the U.S. would veto in the U.N. Security Council this Palestinian bid, and he delivered a major address at the U.N. laying out his position, his administration's position, and explaining the U.S. position, an address that has generated a lot of commentary around the world. During the Cold War era, the Soviet Union would sometimes veto resolutions in the United Nations Security Council that were backed by most of the world. And the U.S. used to take some pride in the fact that the U.S. and the rest of the world were on one side, and the Soviet Union and its dependent states were on the other. In other words, the U.S. was on the side of, generally speaking, world opinion when it came to the Cold War U.S.-Soviet rivalry. But in recent years, that situation has completely changed. The United States now routinely vetoes resolutions in the United Nations Security Council that are critical of Israel, resolutions that sometimes do little more than merely affirm the Palestinian people's rights to basic justice and fairness in the Middle East, and which condemn Israel for policies that, at least on paper, the United States says that it also opposes. But in recent years, time and again, in the UN Security Council, the United States has cast vetoes to block measures by much of the world on the Israel-Palestine issue, and thereby shows that it's not only opposing world opinion and it's the principles it claims to uphold, but it does so not on an issue of really basic importance for America, but to defend Israel and Zionist interests. When Barack Obama was campaigning for the presidency in the year 2008, he did a lot of promising of change, and his many millions of fans and followers, not only here in the United States, but around the world, eagerly expected that, as president, Barack Obama would usher in a new era of hope and change. In fact, the level of hope and anticipation was so great around the world that Barack Obama was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, not for anything he had actually done, but as an expression of the hope that millions of people had around the world for what they expected he would do. In December 2008, that is, a few weeks after Obama had been elected president, but before he actually took office, I was interviewed about what we're likely to expect from the new American leader. That interview was published in a major Middle East daily newspaper, the Tehran Times. In the interview, I said that the much-promised change of the Barack Obama administration would be mostly cosmetic. No one, I said, should be under any illusion about Obama, because he had made very clear over and over that he fundamentally accepts an American role as a global policeman. I predicted that Obama would doubtless make an effort to solve the Israel-Palestine issue, an issue that the whole world realizes and American leaders realize is an important one. But I said that just as with other American presidents who've tried to solve the issue, he would try to do so in a way that upholds and consolidates the position of the Zionist state in the Middle East. The blunt reality, I said, is that every American president is obliged to carry out a foreign policy approved by the organized Jewish community. Well, that prediction made in that interview in 2008 has turned out more or less as I predicted, and manifest in the speech that Barack Obama made in the United Nations just the other week. The French news agency AFP wrote an article about the Israeli reaction to Obama's recent speech. The article said, "Israeli newspapers were unanimous on Thursday in characterizing U.S. President Barack Obama's UN speech as hugely supportive of Israel, but some argued it was perhaps too much of a good thing." The agency went on to note that the leading and largest circulation Israeli daily newspaper, Yediot Aharonot, wrote that, quote, "Obama not only adopted all of the Israeli arguments against recognizing a Palestinian state by means of the UN, he adopted the basic Israeli narrative." And the French news agency report went on to note that most Israeli newspapers referred to next year's U.S. presidential elections as a major factor in determining the tone and content of President Obama's address at the UN. A more pointed commentary about Obama's speech was made by a very shrewd and seasoned Israeli observer, Yuri Avneri. In a column about the speech, Yuri Avneri wrote and characterized the speech by Obama, and I'm quoting, "a work of art, the art of hypocrisy. Almost every statement in the passage of his speech at the UN concerning the Israel-Palestine issue was a lie, a blatant lie. The speaker knew it was a lie, and so did the audience. It was Obama at his best, Obama at his worst. Being a pragmatic person, he knew that he had to do it if he wanted to be reelected. In essence, he sold the fundamental national interests of the United States of America for the chance of a second term. Barack Obama's miserable performance was a nail in the coffin of America's status as a superpower. In a way, it was a crime against the United States." Yuri Avneri hit the nail on the head. First of all, because he and the rest of the world understands that Barack Obama's speech at the UN was deceitful. It was a lie, basically. He portrayed the situation precisely the opposite of the reality, somehow giving the impression that the Israelis are the victims and the Palestinians are somehow the oppressors. Barack Obama's speech, in which he claims to uphold principles of democracy and fairness, was belied by the reality of what of the policies he's trying to defend. But as Avneri points out, Barack Obama's miserable performance also severely hurts America's status as a power in the world, because it underscores the essential hypocrisy and deceit of U.S. policy and position in the world, and makes America all that more unbelievable in what it says its policy is. One of the best-informed and shrewdest observers of international affairs is a former CIA counterterrorism specialist and military intelligence officer named Philip Giraldi. Philip Giraldi was a military intelligence officer of the CIA, and he's been a columnist and commentator. His writings are well worth reading because he brings to the subject a great deal of experience, thought, and education. Giraldi is executive director now of the Council for the National Interest in Washington, D.C., which is a very good group that does valuable work in advocating for a more even-handed U.S. policy in the Middle East. Giraldi is well-educated. He earned a master's and doctoral degree in European history from the University of London. For 18 years, he worked for the CIA in Turkey, Italy, Germany, and Spain, and he speaks the languages of those countries he served in. Giraldi wrote an insightful and useful commentary on the current state of the Israel-Palestine issue, and Barack Obama's speech, and the application by Palestine for full membership in the United Nations. In this commentary, Giraldi wrote, "If the Palestinian application for full membership actually takes place, and the United States uses its Security Council veto to stop the process, it will be the first step in a predictable and preventable tragedy playing out. Any expectation that the president might hesitate, either because it is the right thing to do or because it benefits the United States, is fanciful, particularly with a presidential election looming in 2012. The mainstream media has echoed Israeli and American arguments that Palestinian statehood is meaningless without a negotiated settlement of issues on the ground. But Israel has made it clear that it has no desire to negotiate anything while it continues to occupy the West Bank. So the Palestinian choice is to accept the status quo, in which it is powerless and voiceless, or attempt to line up the international community more solidly behind it and shift the playing field." Giraldi goes on, since it, that is the Palestinian statehood bid, will certainly pass with a huge majority in the General Assembly of the UN, if the Palestinians opt to go that route, it will provide overwhelming international confirmation of Palestinian rights, with the U.S. and Israel standing on the wrong side of the issue. It will also severely undermine Israel's moral position, such as it is, and emphasize the illegality of the Israeli occupation of parts of the West Bank. The process is already illegal in the eyes of the rest of the world, including the United States, but it will be even less tenable if a convincing majority of the world's countries recognize Palestine as a state with defined borders and a national identity. Second, Giraldi goes on, recognition of statehood carries with it recognition that the state exists within defined space, in this case, the 1967 borders. This has enormous significance because those borders include many areas being colonized by the Israelis as well as East Jerusalem. It means that any Israeli settlement that is on the other side of that border is considered completely illegal, and that Israel is therefore a rogue state that is occupying and settling lands belonging to a neighboring state 44 years after the cessation of hostilities. If the Palestinians are in the United Nations as a full member or even with limited rights, they will have access to the International Criminal Court in The Hague, where they can take legal steps against Israel and against individual Israelis. Even though Israel doesn't recognize the legitimacy of the court, when it reaches the point where no senior Israeli government official, present or retired, can travel without concern over being arrested, it will have a major impact on how Israel sees itself and on how the rest of the world sees Israel. The clear depiction of Israel as an occupying power in violation of the Geneva Conventions, to which most of the world's nations are signatories, would also fuel the Israel divestment campaign, which is another major concern of the Israeli government, and also, legitimately so, as it could have a serious impact on the Israeli economy. Giraldi goes on to point out how the U.S. veto and the U.S. policy is being perceived very, very negatively across the Arab world and in Muslim countries. It is seen, he says, as on the one hand supporting liberalization and democratization of some Arab governments, while at the same time suppressing fundamental rights in places like Palestine. Worse still, if Washington cuts aid to the Palestinians because of their going to the UN, it will be widely perceived as a de facto partner and enabler of the occupation of the West Bank. The unfortunately well-deserved perception of blatant hypocrisy will alienate emerging Arab Spring regimes even more from Washington and will almost certainly lead to anti-American violence, possibly extreme, in places like Egypt, Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Turkey. American goods and services will, as a consequence, undoubtedly become less welcome in many parts of the world, while the U.S. veto will inevitably provide a recruiting bonanza for groups that use terror, including Al-Qaeda. And it could make every American traveler less safe when he or she goes abroad, while American soldiers stationed in foreign lands will inevitably become targets of militants inspired by yet another example of Washington's hypocrisy. Giraldi goes on to note how Saudi Arabia has also pointedly warned that the U.S. veto of the bid for Palestinian statehood will do irreparable harm and damage to its bilateral relationship with Washington and also forever destroy America's reputation in the Arab world. It would hasten the development of the clash of civilizations, us and them point of view, dividing much of the developing world from Washington. It would be the final and irrevocable step in a foreign policy that has brought nothing but disasters over the past 10 years. Giraldi's analysis is not unique. Just about every seasoned, knowledgeable observer of the Middle East situation understands the basic points that Garaldi and others are making here. That's why the take on the Israel-Palestine issue and on Israel and Palestine's bid for membership in the United Nations is looked at so differently in the rest of the world as compared to how it's looked at here in the United States. And this is an expression, of course, of the Zionist Jewish grip on the mass media here in the United States, which is blatantly pro-Israel in a way that the rest of the world simply doesn't accept and doesn't understand and is increasingly understanding. Another person who is a seasoned observer of the Middle East is Robert Fisk. He's been a journalist in the Middle East for many years and writes for The Independent, one of the most prestigious and influential British daily newspapers. He was also writing about the speech by Obama in the United Nations. He wrote, "For the American president who called for an end to the Israeli occupation of Arab lands, an end to the theft of Arab lands in the West Bank, Israeli settlements is what he used to call it, and a Palestinian state by 2011, Obama's performance was pathetic." Fisk mentions that Hanan Ashrawi, the Palestinian leader, got it right. "I couldn't believe what I heard," she said. "It sounded as though the Palestinians were the ones occupying Israel." And Fisk comments, "Too true. As usual, the sanest Israeli journalists, in their outspoken condemnation of Obama, prove that the princes of American journalists were cowards." And Fisk goes on to emphasize, "The U.S. administration remains a tool of Israel when it comes to Israel's refusal to give Palestinians a state." In another article in The Independent, Robert Fisk wrote, "The Palestinians won't get a state this week, but they will prove that they are worthy of statehood. The U.S., on the other hand, has lost its purchase on the Middle East. It's over. The peace process, the roadmap, the Oslo Agreement, the whole fandango is history. We are now talking of much graver matters," Fisk goes on. "This vote at the UN is going to divide the West, Americans from Europeans and scores of other nations, and it is going to divide the Arabs from the Americans. It is going to crack open the divisions in the European Union between Eastern and Western Europeans, between Germany and France, the former supporting Israel for all the usual historical reasons, the latter sickened by the suffering of Palestinians, and of course between Israel and the UN. A great anger has been created in the world by decades of Israeli power and military brutality and colonization. Millions of Europeans are no longer cowed in their criticism for fear of being abused as anti-Semites." Fisk goes on to make another good point. Where exactly, geographically, is Israel? It is the only nation on earth which does not know and will not declare where its eastern frontier is. Is it the old UN armistice line, the 1967 border, or is it the whole of the West Bank? That's one of the peculiarities of this whole conflict. The Palestinians are applying for a membership in the United Nations on the basis that their borders are the borders that the world recognizes, the 1967 borders. Israel, for its part, does not and never has said what its borders are. It talks about security, but this is fantastic considering that it won't say what its borders are. How can a country have secure borders if it won't say what those borders are? On this matter alone, of course, on other matters as well, Palestine and the Palestinian representatives are on much more solid and reasonable grounds than are the Israelis, because they will say what their borders are, and what they are asking for is consistent with international law, even as affirmed by the United States. In the new Middle East, amid the Arab awakening and the revolt of free peoples for dignity and freedom, this UN vote, passed in the General Assembly, vetoed by America if it goes to the Security Council, constitutes a kind of hinge, not just a page-turning, but the failure of empire. So locked into Israel has U.S. foreign policy become, so fearful of Israel have almost all its congressmen and congresswomen become, to the extent of loving Israel more than America, that America this week will stand out as a curmudgeonly, selfish, frightened state whose president, after promising a new affection for the Muslim world, is forced to support an occupying power against a people who ask only for statehood. Well, we'll take a break at this point and return with the second half of this broadcast.
Stay tuned for more of the Mark Weber Report. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Now, the UN Security Council is considering the Palestinian administration's membership for statehood. Leader Mahmoud Abbas officially submitted their United Nations application last week. Israel and the United States strongly oppose the idea. RT's Marina Portnoy is following the consultations for us in New York. Let's talk to her now. Marina, how long is this going to take and where's the smart money on how the vote will go?
Well, in terms of how long this is supposed to take, the process takes no longer than 35 days. Excuse me, that should be the maximum of which this standing committee will assess and review the application for Palestinian UN membership and statehood. The standing committee will hold its first meeting on Friday, and the application that the Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas handed in calls for a recognition of a Palestinian state in the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem as its capital. Now, so far, there is about six Security Council members on record that have thrown their support behind the Palestinian bid. A total of 9 out of the 15 countries need to support the application, and there has to be no vetoes. None of the veto-wielding members of the Security Council should cast a veto. As we know, the United States, a staunch ally of Israel, has vowed to veto the Palestinian bid for UN membership if it has to. Israel is very much opposed to this. The U.S., President Barack Obama, said the only way that there can be an independent Palestinian state is if the Palestinians and the Israelis get back to the negotiation table and discuss a Middle East peace plan that comes to fruition. So at this point, some critics say that the Palestinian campaign for UN membership is doomed to fail, but the Palestinians are very appreciative that the Security Council is moving so quickly. And at the very least, this is bringing attention to a problem that has lasted for decades and has not yet been solved.
Well, this consultation does come hot on the heels, doesn't it, of Israel's decision to expand their settlements in disputed East Jerusalem and build some 1,100 new homes. Where does this leave the peace process in the Middle East, such as it is?
Clearly, this makes the circumstance that much harder. There has been, condemnation coming from the international community against Israel's plan to expand its settlements. Russia has said it's deeply concerned with the plan and hopes that it would be revised. The United States and European Union also voiced criticism of this plan. Some critics say that the settlement expansion is actually a violation of international law. And if anything, Israel's actions can be seen as provoking an already sensitive circumstance, not helping to reach.
Let's return to the Mark Weber Report, brought to you by VOR.
Hello and welcome back. When we went on break, I was quoting from an article by Robert Fisk, the veteran journalist for the independent newspaper in London, about the recent speech by Barack Obama and the dispute or the controversy about Palestine's bid for a membership as a state in the United Nations. Fisk was emphasizing how increasingly the United States and Israel are at odds with the rest of the world over the issue of Israel-Palestine and other issues as well. And the United States is seen increasingly as a weak and beholden country, unable to soberly and intelligently represent even its own interests. This has been underscored strongly, emphasized in recent weeks, by the way in which both Egypt and Turkey have taken positions increasingly hostile to Israel. The more democratic a country is, the more representative its government is of the genuine feelings and interests of its people, the more it will oppose Israel and oppose its Zionist efforts to push its policies with support from others. The more a country, the more a people has a firm understanding of its real interests, and the more aware a country is, the more it opposes Israel policy and U.S. Support for Israel. And that's been very manifest in the aftermath of the so-called Arab Spring transformation that's taking place across the Middle East. The most important Arab country in population and traditionally culturally is Egypt. And after the overthrow of the Mubarak regime, Egypt has been taking a policy stance increasingly hostile to Israel. But perhaps more important has been the shift of policy in Turkey. Turkey is an important regional player. At one time it had a military partnership with Israel and was even had a military alliance with the United States. All that has changed, and all those are straws in the wind that show an increasing awareness around the world, not really that what Israel is doing is wrong or immoral or unjust or oppressive, but that Israeli interests and American interests in the Middle East, which are predicated and based upon what's good for Israel, is contrary to the interests of other countries. What drives American policy was made explicit recently by the new American ambassador to Israel. His name is Daniel Shapiro. In a recent address, Daniel Shapiro said explicitly that the test of every policy the administration develops in the Middle East is whether it is consistent with the goal of ensuring Israel's future as a secure Jewish democratic state. That is a commitment that runs as a common thread through our entire government. Now, this is important because this high-ranking U.S. official, Shapiro, U.S. ambassador to Israel, publicly and explicitly acknowledged what the IHR and what other analysts of the Middle East situation and of U.S. policy have been emphasizing for years. U.S. policy in the Middle East is not based on what is best for the United States or humanity or the world or peace. It's based, as he said, on whether it is consistent with the goal of ensuring Israel's future as a secure Jewish democratic state. There's no other country in the world that the United States has that kind of relationship with. The United States does not guarantee or is concerned about the ethnic religious identity of a foreign country. It doesn't say that Ireland has to stay a Catholic state or a white state. It doesn't say that Pakistan has to stay a Muslim state. It is only in the case of Israel that the United States is dedicated to ensuring Israel's character and as a specifically Jewish ethno-religious state. And, as Shapiro says, it's a commitment that runs as a common thread through our entire government. That's another way of saying that this pro-Zionist position, this pro-Zionist, pro-Israel policy, subsumes, is entirely integrated with the American political system. And that's important because of the tragedy this means for the American public. To put it bluntly, to have a policy that is firmly supportive of Israel and its interests means carrying out policies which by their very nature will be hostile, will be not in the interests of America and the world. One of the commentators on the recent speech by Obama was a writer for BBC News. He mentioned that Barack Obama's speech at the UN was welcomed by almost all major American Jewish organizations and regarded in the media as his most pro-Israel yet. But as he pointed out, amazingly, the current crop of Republican presidential hopefuls had a very different take. Texas Governor Rick Perry, who's often considered a front runner as the Republican nominee for president in 2012, blamed the president for encouraging the Palestinians to seek membership in the UN. Speaking to a Jewish audience, he called Obama's policies dangerous for Israel and said that they are naive, arrogant, misguided. He said that Obama's policies were not sufficiently supportive of Israel, even though Obama has said that he will veto any measure in the United Nations to give status as a state to Palestine. Former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney, who is another leading Republican candidate for president, called the events in the UN an unmitigated diplomatic disaster and said, and quoting a line he said earlier, he went on, "It is the culmination of President Obama's repeated efforts over 3 years to throw Israel under the bus." Well, this is not only untrue, it's precisely the opposite of the truth. These incendiary claims are not merely untrue, they're lies, they're conscious untruths. Now, there's several ways to demonstrate and prove what I'm saying about this. First of all, Obama's policy with regard to Israel and the Palestine issue is completely consistent with U.S. policy over the past 20, 30, 40 years. Obama has not made any new policy. It's true that he said that Israel should not continue to build settlements in the occupied West Bank territories. But that's nothing new in U.S. policy. That's been U.S. policy for years. Now, there's no American president that conservatives and Republicans point to with greater admiration in recent years than Ronald Reagan. Well, Ronald Reagan's position on the settlements is completely consistent with that of Barack Obama. It's Rick Perry and Mitt Romney who are making a new and different policy than that of even Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan's most detailed and important presentation of his policy on the Middle East was in a major speech he gave on September 1st, 1982. And he outlined what he called the Reagan Plan for solving the Israel-Palestine issue. Now, I'm mentioning this, and I'm going to quote from this, because it shows the extent to which Mitt Romney and Rick Perry and other leading Republicans are out of sync in their criticisms of Barack Obama, even with the policies of earlier Republican presidents, including Ronald Reagan. Now, in this speech from 1982, Reagan said, and I'm quoting, "The United States will not support the use of any additional land for the purpose of settlements during the transition period." He's referring, in other words, the United States will not support additional Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank. Reagan went on, "Indeed, the immediate adoption of a settlement freeze by Israel, more than any other action, could create the confidence needed for wider participation in these talks." Reagan went on, "We base our approach squarely on the principle that the Arab-Israeli conflict should be resolved through the negotiations involving an exchange of territory for peace. This exchange is enshrined in United Nations Security Council Resolution 242, which is, in turn, incorporated in all its parts in the Camp David agreements. UN Resolution 242 remains wholly valid as the foundation stone of America's Middle East peace efforts. It is the United States' position that, in return for peace, the withdrawal provision of Resolution 242 applies to all fronts, including the West Bank and Gaza. Unquote. Well, that's even more supposedly anti-Israel than Barack Obama's position. Now, Resolution 242 was passed by the United Nations Security Council in 1967. Resolution 242, that was endorsed by President Reagan, says that Israel must withdraw from all occupied territories, including the West Bank. That means that Israeli settlement building is not only, as Obama has said, not helpful to peace, it's illegal under this Security Council resolution, which has the force of law internationally and even in the United States. So what Obama's position on this is completely consistent with that of Ronald Reagan and of international law. What Mitt Romney and Rick Perry are asking and urging is a policy by the United States that repudiates international law and the obligations of the United States under the United Nations Security Council Resolution 242. But that's typical of the positions of some of these people. They don't care about law or justice or what's right or even what is consistent with long-standing interests, of course, interests of the United States. They're trying to gain support from the organized Jewish community. And that's why Romney and Perry will make such outrageously false statements as they did recently about Obama's speech. Moreover, the position of Romney and Perry, who call themselves conservatives, is inconsistent with what conservatives used to think is the cornerstone of U.S. foreign policy. That is, to put American interests above those of any foreign country, and to avoid what's called a passionate attachment to any foreign country. This was laid out in the famous farewell address by the first American president, George Washington, who warned against any what he called passionate attachment to a foreign state. But the fervent backing for the Zionist state by Perry, Romney, Bachman, and even, of course, in his speeches earlier by Barack Obama, across the board, in other words, for both parties, means that they reject the principles and warnings of America's founders. It also means they betray the principles of justice and democracy which they claim to uphold. It means, more to the point, that these politicians cannot be trusted. And that's why this might be less amazing when coming from a candidate or a political leader who calls himself liberal, but it's more shameful when coming from a candidate or a political figure like Rick Perry or Mitt Romney who call themselves conservative. What they show is that they routinely betray authentic and traditional Christian conservative principles. And instead, in their eagerness to try to curry favor and support from the organized Jewish community. Now, the fact that U.S. Support for Israel is contrary to basic American interests is not some fantastic theory by someone who hates Israel. This is the view that every serious specialist of U.S. Middle East policy understood back in 1947-48 when Israel was being established as a state. One of the most impressive and upstanding and outstanding American foreign policy specialists was a career diplomat named Loy Henderson. At one time he served as U.S. ambassador to India, to Iran, to Iraq, He's still regarded as one of the most important and distinguished career diplomats in U.S. history. He's not well known outside of the State Department. He wasn't a major public figure, but he was a shrewd and, by all accounts, an honest and incorruptible U.S. official, even when he was carrying out policies that he didn't particularly agree with. There's a good bit devoted to him in a book entitled The Arabists, which talks about State Department officials who are specialists of the Middle East policy. Loy Henderson was director of the Office of Near Eastern and African Affairs of the U.S. State Department, and he warned strongly against U.S. support for Israel. In a memo written shortly after World War II, he wrote, "Support by the government of the United States of a policy favoring the setting up of a Jewish state in Palestine would be contrary to the wishes of a large majority of the local inhabitants with respect to their form of government. Furthermore, it would have a strongly adverse effect upon American interests throughout the Near and Middle East." He went on to emphasize, "At the present time, that is 1945, the United States has a moral prestige in the Near and Middle East unequaled by that of any other great power. We would lose that prestige and would be likely for many years to be considered as a betrayer of the high principles which we ourselves have enunciated during the period of the war." Well, of course, Loy Henderson's warning was completely borne out by the events that have taken place in the years since. When the Zionists began a campaign to push a partition plan to divide Palestine and set up a Jewish state, at that time in 1947-48, Jews made up only about 30% of the inhabitants of Palestine and owned only about 6% of the land. Now, the partition that finally was authorized by the UN gave Jews, Zionists, no less than 55% of Palestine, even though they made up only 30% of the population. This was a basic betrayal of the U.S. stated policy of self-determination and democracy, and of course was regarded as such and as a betrayal by much of the world. At the time, Henderson went on to write, "Partition would guarantee that the Palestine problem would be permanent and still more complicated in the future." Again, this was a prediction he made back in 1947. "Proposals for partition are in definite contravention to various principles laid down in the UN Charter as well as to principles on which American concepts of government are based. These proposals, for instance, ignore such principles as self-determination and majority rule. They recognize the principle of a theocratic racial state and even go so far in several instances as to discriminate on grounds of religion and race." In November 1947, Henderson circulated yet another memo and wrote that the plan for a Jewish state is contrary to the interests of the United States and will eventually involve us in international difficulties of so grave a character that the reaction throughout the world, as well in this country, will be very strong. Unquote. Well, again, subsequent events completely bore out the validity of the warning that Loy Henderson made. And, not surprisingly, at the time, the Zionists viciously attacked Henderson, calling him an anti-Semite, demanding his resignation, and even threatening his family. But Henderson wasn't alone. Nearly every member of the Foreign Service of the State Department who's worked in any appreciable extent on Near Eastern problems agreed with him. George Kennan, who was not only State Department Director of Policy Planning and one of the outstanding historians, American historians of the 20th century, also opposed U.S. support for a Jewish state in Palestine and warned about the long-term consequences. He was joined in this by Undersecretary of State Dean Acheson and by Secretary of Defense James Forrestal, who also tried unsuccessfully to oppose the Zionists. He said that President Truman, in supporting Zionist ambitions, was doing so for what Forrestal called squalid political purposes. And Forrestal warned United States policy should be based on United States national interests and not on domestic political considerations. Forrestal, who was Secretary of Defense, the U.S. first Secretary of Defense, by the way, echoed the general feeling in the Pentagon about what the basis of U.S. policy in the Middle East should be. That is, no group, as he wrote, in this country should be permitted to influence our policy to the point where it could endanger our national security. When one U.S. congressman warned that the Democratic Party would lose if a plan against a Zionist state was proposed, if a Zionist state was not supported, Forrestal responded, quote, "I think it is about time that somebody should pay some consideration to whether we might not lose the United States." And typically, of course, Forrestal was subject to the usual smears and venomous personal attacks, which is also typical of the treatment meted out to anybody who tries to uphold authentic U.S. interests in the Middle East. So it's worth stressing that, Forrestal and others, most dramatically, the Secretary of State George C. Marshall was opposed to U.S. backing for a Zionist state in 1948. He angrily told President Truman that recognizing Israel would put partisan political interests above America's national interest, and he warned the president that he did not think he could support him in the presidential election campaign if he were to support Israel. At that time, it was just merely a policy of even recognizing the state of Israel. But this is what I call the original sin of U.S. Middle East policy, because American presidents since then have put the interests of their party or of their own political careers above the authentic interests of the American people. A recent poll showed that American levels of distrust and dissatisfaction with the American political system have reached an all-time high. A new Gallup poll shows a record high 81% of Americans are dissatisfied with the way the country is being governed, adding to a negativity that has been building over the past 10 years. Now, the point I want to stress here is that the U.S. support for Israel and the support for Israel by U.S. politicians is an integral part of this kind of systematic corruption, that is, putting their personal interests and career interests above the interests of the American people, and that U.S. support for Israel is a manifestation of a basic entrenched problem that manifests itself not only in U.S. Middle East policy, but in the selling out of the interests of the American people across the board on all issues of importance, whether it's the economy, jobs, cultural policy, and so forth. Even Americans who don't particularly care if their political leaders are pro-Israel should be concerned about this. The ardent blank check support of Israel and its policies by the political leaders of both major parties is not just a position. It's an expression of a deep-rooted opportunism and corruption that puts the interests of a small but influential minority above the interests of the American people and of the world. Fortunately, although many Americans still accept this shameful spectacle, something is changing, and ever more Americans realize that something is severely, fundamentally wrong with the U.S. system. What's needed is a sharp break with the past based on a sound understanding of history and of the world political economic reality. That concludes this broadcast. I hope you'll join me for the next Mark Weber Report.
Thanks for listening. The Mark Weber Show returns Wednesday, 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. Time, only on VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.